thank each one of you for being here. I think it's a miracle gathering because of the leadership responsibility that you have and the gifting that God has bestowed upon you for His glory and His kingdom purpose. Robbie and I both considered it an honor that we could join with you and join hearts to seek our Father's heart. I have been around for a while, and I'll be 73 in a few weeks. I never dreamed I'd reach this age. I thought I'd always be a youth evangelist. But I'm grateful that God has allowed me to live to see 11 grandchildren. The youngest now is 17. The oldest is 30. And we have a little great-grandson. But I never dreamed that I would be able to see a family like I've seen when I grew up fatherless. And to see how much our children and grandchildren love one another. I think most of you know our youngest daughter is in heaven. And we watched her oldest son get married last Saturday, a week ago. And we know Mom was watching too. And to hear her son at his own wedding say such beautiful things about his mom. I said to our 11 grandchildren at Christmas that I said, I've never seen cousins love each other so much. You're crazy about each other. Our son has 4 children, our oldest daughter 4, and our daughter that's in heaven had 3. And I said, you just love each other so much. And so help me, they began to talk about how much they do. And it was like I heard Jesus say to his Father, don't we wish we could say that about our family? And I can tell you as a father, a grandfather, and great-grandfather, my heart longs to see the Father's family begin to reveal the heart of our Father, the love of our Father, the wisdom of our Father to His family, and then reveal it through the family to a world that's groping in darkness, deceived and defeated in so many ways. I hope you'll join me in that spirit, that God will just reveal His heart to us and then through us. The only hope we've got is the wisdom that God freely offers and is so seldom received. I really believe God has set the stage right now for us to walk through a door only He could open. And I have found myself praying, God, let amazing grace that John Newton shared with Wilberforce, let it be multiplied 100 times over in its dynamic impact and effect. In this day, the transforming power of God that birthed the great awakenings, the likes of which we need again and even greater. And we can have it. I see opportunity everywhere I look. I'm not too old to see that. I will not settle for a rocker. I'm not checking out, opting out. I am standing up, standing with you. And let me say this to you. One of the strongest things in my heart right now is knowing that there is a river in you that you may not even comprehend the greatness and potential of. But inside of me is that burning desire to release the river that's in you to flow freely to the ends of the earth for the glory of God. I'm sitting by a man that I honor and respect and admire as much as anyone I know. He's a treasure. And I find myself, when I pray for Robbie, God, multiply the impact of everything you have miraculously imparted to him. Multiply it 100-fold. He's about to open a center, which we and maybe many of you will help him do in the Atlanta area. Whereas one person said to me today, this man is so great, but he needs to be multiplied many times over. And I think maybe you said that to me a moment ago too, Robert, because our church has given nearly $2 million to help him do what he's called to do. We're helping him. What is it? He's going to multiply what God put in him because there's one Ravi, but there can be many, which is exactly what Jesus left us here to do, and we will help you do it. But I believe Ravi is here to help all of us be in Christ and Christ in us. What he longs to be. I am telling you, we can witness the greatest move of God in the history of the world. Think about this. Jesus is coming back for a bride that looks like him. Not divided, defeated, desecrated. but adorned in His glory. Many people say, when's He coming? I honestly think I know. I think we can settle it here today. This ought to give you a tremendous amount of theological peace. I really believe I know when He's coming. I believe in the perhaps not too distant future. It doesn't really matter. I believe the Father will turn to the Son and He'll say, Son, look, there's your bride. She looks just like you. Let's go get her. It has nothing to do numerically with how big the church is, but how big He is in that body. And I don't know if you did, but I watched them cut the heads off those Coptic Christians because I felt like God told me to watch. And when I watched them led out there on that beach in those jumpsuits, and they cut their heads off, and they set their heads on their chest, and they panned the line, I saw on their countenance, I saw a peace that passes understanding. And I said, I don't know if that peace prevails in me, but I want it to. But I also heard God say, that's not the end I intend for my church. I am offering you the invitation I offered Jerusalem when I knew desolation was coming. I knew it would be leveled. I knew they had rejected the prophets. I knew they had scorned the truth and cast aside and found themselves as slaves in the land that I gave them. I knew. But I said, oh, Jerusalem, how long, in the face of all you've sown, the consequences of the rottenness of your actions, I'm inviting you to come like chicks to the wings of the hen. And Ravi, I don't know if it's a vision. Baptists are not supposed to have visions. But old men do, and I'm an old man. And so help me. I want so bad to believe, because I've seen the little chicks run to the wings of the chicken. I just had a duck in our subdivision. It had about 7 little ducklings. And if you didn't see the Facebook piece where those firemen were getting down in the sewer and getting these little baby ducks out recently and putting them back up, with this one mama duck waiting beside the highway with her one baby duck that she had while about 7 or 8 are in the sewer, the drain pipe, and they got every one of them. She waited till every one of them was beside her, and then she let them off. I said, boy, she's a better mom than a lot of moms and dads are today. But here's what I saw in our subdivision. I saw a duck, a mallard that had all these little chicks, and I watched somebody run over to that to get to that duck, and that duck puffed up like this. It went, and I want you to know that's the baddest duck I ever saw in my life. And those little chicks, those little ducklings just ran there. Robbie, I honestly thought when I saw the beauty of Jesus' invitation of grace, and I saw those little chicks that I'd seen in the farmyard, I thought I saw Americans running to the shelter, not because we had been nuked into oblivion, but because we had gotten on our face in response to that glorious invitation of grace. And I believe He's extending it to us today, to every person who seeks office, to every person who prays for leaders, every person who seeks to lead, that we would come to that shelter and live in that shadow. That's not just my heart cry, and it is my heart cry, but above all, it's His heart cry. It's not only His will and His desire, but it's what He enables us to experience. The church can walk into that presence and that power, that anointing, that divine enabling, and deliver the transforming truth of the gospel to the world in the face of all the challenges in our day. We can soar like eagles on the turbulence of the times and the challenges of this day. and we must inspire the church to do it. Thank you so much for coming. Robbie's going to share, and I'd just like you to give him a real good welcome to us today.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining us on a day like this for the momentous events that surround your life and mine. It's amazing all over the world, and I go and travel, and even within a week from now, we'll be in Hong Kong and Taiwan and so on. Same question is being asked, especially by the young. What's happened to America? What's gone wrong? They're noticing that things are simply not right. It was about 2 months ago, I was in Moscow having spoken at one of the events and having breakfast with one businessman out there. And he looked at me and he said, you know, my hope has always been for the future of the world that America would rise to the occasion and somehow come to the rescue. He said, I don't have that hope anymore. And here's what he said. His English was not the best, but he put it this way. He said, they don't think right there anymore. He said, they're not thinking right there anymore. It was in the latter part of the 60s that Malcolm Muggeridge, one of my great heroes, said this. It is difficult to resist the conclusion that 20th century man has decided to abolish himself. Tired of the struggle to be himself, he has created boredom out of his own affluence, impotence out of his own erotomania, and vulnerability out of his own strength. He himself blows the trumpet that brings the walls of his own cities crashing down, until at last, having educated himself into imbecility, having drugged and polluted himself into stupefaction, he keels over, a weary, battered old brontosaurus, and becomes extinct. He keels over, a weary, battered old brontosaurus, and becomes extinct. Ironically, around the same time, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was getting the Nobel Prize. And here's what he said. I refuse to believe that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in a river of life. I refuse to believe that mankind is so starlessly bound to the dark midnight and racism of war, at racism and war, that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. And then he said this, I believe unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. A very battered old brontosaurus and becoming extinct, unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. Which of the two ways are we going to go? If Dr. King is right, then our whole educational system is wrong.
Exactly.
I'll tell you why. Naturalism does not give you the imperative of unarmed truth and unconditional love. Those are metaphysical propositions, truth and love. They are not the natural bequest of a test tube lifestyle that works in the lab and tells you what happens when such and such mixes with such and such. The imperative of truth and love really are metaphysical propositions, and may I dare suggest to you, they are embedded in the Judeo-Christian worldview. The imperatives of truth and love are deeply embedded in the Judeo-Christian worldview. It was about 7 years ago, I was in Damascus, one of my favorite stops in the world. I'd been there many times, and every time I arrived there, the chief of intelligence would always bring me in for the same briefing, the same plate of baklava sitting in front of me, which none of us dared touch because the sternness on his face took away any appetite for any sweets or whatever. But he would look at me and say, Mr. Zacharias, we know you are here and we welcome you. Just don't get involved in the politics of the region. And it was the same line. And I said, I don't plan to get involved in the politics. But this time I said something different. I said, but since you are, can you tell me what's really going on in this part of the world now? This is about 7 years ago, before everything broke loose. Here's what he said to me. I quoted him immediately after I came back because I had his permission. He said, I give this part of the world no more than 5 years and the whole thing is going to blow up if nothing changes. If nothing changes here, the whole place is going to blow up. Did he know something then? Did he know ISIS was looming in the background? Did he know of all the terror that stalked them? He is one of the first to be assassinated after everything collapsed out there, long before this all began. Today, what are they talking about? Maybe 200,000? In a city that had a man in a basket lowered over the wall to bring the message of salvation and hope, he himself being a terrorist, having been converted, and took the message of peace all over the globe and gave to us one-third of the New Testament. And as I take that story and illustration in the background, which of us knows what looms ahead in the next 5 years here? What lies ahead for us? I want to talk about four or five very important things that I think we need to be involved in, and that is this. As you look at the platforms before us politically, I ask one question, then two, then three, then four. What is the most valuable thing in the world? What is the most valuable thing in the world? Winston Churchill said it, the most valuable thing in the world is the truth. He said, in fact, it is so valuable that often it is hidden by a bodyguard of lies. Natan Sharansky, former Israeli justice minister, when he was incarcerated for his former Soviet Union, made this comment when he went to visit the prison where he'd been incarcerated, and then asked if he could go and lay a wreath at the grave of Sakharov, the physicist who gave to the Soviets the atomic bomb. Here's what he said. The most powerful weapon in the world, said Sakharov, is not the bomb that I've given to you all. He said, the most powerful weapon in the world is the truth. If the most valuable thing in the world is the truth, and the most powerful weapon in the world is the truth, how important is the truth on the platforms of this electoral process? If the truth does not survive, you may as well turn the lights out, because to somebody whose mind is bent towards deceit and a lie, the darkness becomes the light.
Yes. That's right.
You may as well turn the lights out then. Mm. Truth is an imperative, so critical in our times. And we as the church need to rise up for two reasons, that we demand of the electoral process that truth be spoken and truthfulness be that by which the politicians live, A. And then we ourselves as Christian leaders, as men and women, live by the truth. Because if we abide in His Word, then we know the truth, and then the truth indeed sets us free. And now as Christians, the time has come for us to ask of the political leadership, truth. Because without truth, we lose the most powerful weapon. Without truth, we lose the most valuable thing. And we live that by example in our own lives. Truthfulness. Truth number one. Number two, I say this. What is the fundamental law of logic? There are three laws of logic, and I just give you the first law. On this hangs everything else. It may seem terribly cerebral, but believe me, it is immensely practical. The most fundamental law of logic is the law of identity. You must be able to identify what it is you're talking about, or you cannot speak anything about that thing. The law of identity. Then you move on to the law of rational inference, the law of non-contradiction, and so on. But the law of identity is key. Now, here's what I want to say to you. If we, as a nation, cannot even identify those who are seeking to destroy us, then we've not only violated the fundamental law of ethics, truth, we're now violating the fundamental law of reason. The law of identity is that which demands of us that we know what it is we're really talking about. It is critical we as Christians come together and pray that our political leadership will be able to identify what it is that is really seeking to threaten us, especially since ideologies abound both within and without that seem to want to pull down the infrastructure. The third thing what I want to talk about is a wall that we don't hear much about. We hear much about many walls these days. Is the wall of religious liberty going to be taken away, going to be put around the church so that we will be hamstrung, that we will be handcuffed, that our freedoms will be taken away from us? If you and I don't stand up and speak with love and speak with concern, the day will come, as Margaret Thatcher warned us, that if the church does not rise up and speak, the political structure will collapse. Now, we've got truth. We've got the law of identity. We've got the religious freedom principle. Why is that critical? I'll tell you why it's critical. We talk about ourselves being as a people of laws, that this nation is a nation of laws. I hear that again and again and again. We are a nation of laws, all right? We're a nation of laws. And if you read Russell Kirk, The Roots of American Order and so on, he'll talk about us being a nation of laws. So we've got the root is the laws. The trunk is the political infrastructure. The branches is the outworking and culture, okay? You've got the roots, the laws, the trunk, the political structure, the branches, the outworking and culture. Here's my question. What is going to hold the roots? The roots don't hold themselves. You need a rich moral soil. That rich moral soil is needed to hold the roots. And for that rich moral soil, the voice of the Christian has to be heard, because the greatest commandment given to mankind ever was not one, but it was two: to love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul and all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Moses had given 613 commandments. Jesus could have reduced it to one. He didn't. He reduced it to two. That there'd be the vertical dimension and then the horizontal dimension. All we hear in politics today is right and left. We've forgotten there's an up and a down. And if we forget there's an up and a down, we'll be choking each other from the right to the left or the left to the right. That's why Jesus never got messed up in that battle, because his kingdom was from another world. His kingdom was vertical. As Solomon said, everything is pointless and emptiness if it's under the sun. If you lock God out, it's all empty and all purposeless, and you are chasing after the wind. You've got the ethical norms that are needed. You've got the logical reality that is needed. You've got the freedom to which God calls us and the moral reasoning to which we must be committed. Gertrude Himmelfarb from Columbia has written a book called Roads to Modernity. Here's this brilliant philosopher who takes one whole chapter of all things to say why America was different to Europe, why America was different to France. And she says America was different because for the French philosophes, for their philosophers, reason was supreme. She says for the American, moral reasoning was supreme. It's an incredible statement made by a very profound thinker. It's not reason with its feet firmly planted in midair, but it's moral reasoning, the distinction between right and wrong, good and evil, which is exactly what Alexander Solzhenitsyn warned us about, the moral reasoning that is needed. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I say to you, your life and my life must show that. If I don't honor my commitment to my family, if I don't honor my commitment to my colleagues, if I don't honor my commitment to what God Himself has called me to, it'll all be once again like chasing after the wind. We need that moral strength, that deep-seated commitment of the soul, so that men and women can look at us and recognize there's a man or a woman whose yea is yea and whose nay is nay, because they are rooted in the bedrock of the unchangeable one, God Himself. We must get that straight. And lastly, I've seen this globe a lot. I traveled over 200 days every year. It's been a torturous, torturous schedule. And I keep asking myself, when am I going to slow down? I've got a beautiful wife, children, grandchildren. And I'll tell you what, there's not another cause in the world for which I'd be traveling like this, but for my Lord, because outside of His transforming power, there is no other hope for mankind. As Konrad Adenauer said to Billy Graham years ago, looking through the window into the broken city of Cologne, he looked at Billy and he said, "Mr. Graham, do you believe Jesus really rose again from the dead?" Billy Graham said, "If I didn't believe that, Mr. Chancellor, I would have no message left to preach." He said, Adenauer paused, looked out of the window, came back, and he said, "Mr. Graham, outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind." Billy Graham said, "I've never forgotten that. outside of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, I know of no other hope for mankind, not the least of which is the reality that justice will finally hold sway. And so the question I ask is, what does the political landscape hold for us? And I console myself with this. It was not Pharaoh that made the difference. It was Joseph in Pharaoh's palace. It was not the Persian monarch that made the difference. It was Daniel who was able to talk to the Persian monarch. It's amazing. You know, the fact of the matter is, it is those who come close, those who stand close to the leader. And my prayer is that that person will be elected who will have the voice of godly people around them. We need the Josephs, the Nehemiahs, the Daniels that they will appoint. They are the ones who have the ear of the king. And so no matter what happens, my prayer is that the Daniels, the Josephs, and the Esthers will emerge, and those voices can change history. A grandson can change the life of a grandfather, and a voice of a cupbearer can change the heart of a monarch. So my prayer is, God, raise up those kinds of people to be in the palace, to be in these precincts and be in those quarters. That should be our prayer. Because you see, if you don't have the voice of a righteous one, you get intoxicated with your own knowledge and your own understanding and drunk with your own power, and you run roughshod over humanity like Rehoboam did. We can't have that. We need the voices. And so I bring this to a close very, very much parenthetically, one end starting off with Syria, and now this end from Jerusalem. Some time ago, I was talking to a Muslim cleric, very powerful man, who was quite hostile, quite angry. And I'd asked him a question, and his answer was not very comforting to me. So I said to him, you know what? I don't like your answer. I said, but I want to tell you something. Where we are sitting, not far from here, is a hill. 5,000 years ago, a man by the name of Abraham took his son up that hill. I said, please, sir, let's not debate which son right now, because that's not the point. I said, he took his son up the hill and was going to sacrifice him as an expression of faith and go before God. He said, I remember the story. I said, but as the axe is about to come down, God stops that arm. He said, that's right. I said, what did God say? He didn't have the answer. God said, stop. I myself will provide. He said, that's right. I said, very close to where you and I are sitting, Sheikh, is a hill. 2,000 years ago, God took his own son up that hill. And this time, the axe did not stop. He just stared at me. I said, Sheikh, until you and I receive the son God has provided, we'll be offering our own sons and daughters on the battlefields of this world for land and position and power and prestige. He just stared at me. And when we left, he turned me around before I got into the car, gave me a kiss on both sides of the face, and he said, Mr. Zacharias, you're a good man. You're a good man. He said, I hope I see you again someday. We're not going to win people by mocking them. We're not going to win people by deriding them. We've got to present the winsomeness and the beauty of the message that God would have us share. People are drawn to the beauty and the love of what they so long for. And ladies and gentlemen, that's your calling and mine. Unarmed truth and unconditional love on the one side, the cross on a hill called Calvary as the point from which we all begin. The days of Jesus were dark, but Saul of Tarsus to Paul changed history. Is it impossible for that to happen in our time? I think not. It could take one person to change the future. You're here to be counted among those people. I pray that a few years from now, we'll look back and say, God surprised us all, and we have a triumph and a glorious message to give. 10 years ago, nobody would have ever thought China would be the fastest growing church in the world. 10 years from now, we might want to look back and say, who would have ever thought America would once again be strong as a people of faith and spread the word of God richly and be taken because of the strength of character, courage, born out of the roots of the moral soil of loving God and loving our fellow man. That's my challenge for you. Thank you so much for giving me a hearing, and God bless you.